Welcome to PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. I'm John Bernstein, regional president of PNC Bank, alongside my co-host Carolyn Jones, market president and publisher of the Boston Business Journal.
Thanks, John. It's great to be with you on PNC C-Speak. Each podcast features local executives talking about relevant and timely business topics. This knowledge-sharing platform showcases leaders with forward-thinking approaches that disrupt the status quo and cause us to think differently. Our guest today is Mike Massaro, Chief Executive Officer of Flywire. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us today. Flywire is in the global payment space and has been very innovative. Could you please tell us a bit about the company and its history?
Yeah, sure thing. So Flywire is at the intersection of software and payments. So most consumers understand, you know, it's easier to tap and pay in a store than ever before. It's easier to purchase maybe too much online in e-commerce nowadays. Those experiences have been curated over the last two decades. But where Flywire focuses is on other parts of the global economy, areas like tuition payments, like medical expenses, certain types of business-related payments where that same level of innovation really hasn't happened over the last two decades. And we're helping those industries innovate with modern payment functionality. So we have a bit of software, we have our own payment infrastructure, and we've been at it for just about 12 years, 10 years as a private company, last 2 years as a public company. We went public in May of 21. And at a corporate level, we get about 1,000 employees, flymates, as we call them, with over 40 nationalities, 30 languages inside the company. So it's a very global team.
That's awesome. Really exciting business. Mike, let's focus on you a bit. Tell us about some of the career pivotal moments that helped to shape your leadership style and that influenced your success.
Yeah, for me, I often say I would have been a miserable management consultant if I went down the path. I happened to go visit a friend at a startup and just kind of saw what he was doing in kind of an innovative tech company in the late 1990s, early 2000s. That was a company called Edox. It was one of the successful exits in tech in Boston. And I ended up joining that company. And it was an amazing experience in my early 20s, getting to work with amazing people. Many of us are still very close to this day. And the company went on to a lot of great successes, got bought by Siebel Systems and Oracle eventually. And what I learned at that experience over that 5 or 6 years, I mean, in a tech company, you're often given, and especially in high growth tech, you're given opportunities to do things that your resume, your experience aren't the factors for why you're given them. It's almost like you raise your hand and you have a pulse and you're given things that you oftentimes wouldn't be given in other environments. And so that environment was amazing. So, you know, got opportunities to implement the product, to be involved in C-suite level conversations in my early 20s, got a chance to move abroad and open up a new market in the UK and Europe and be part of delivering solutions all throughout Europe. Just an amazing set of experiences that really I don't think would have been possible if it wasn't for being part of a successful high growth tech company. So to me, that was probably the most pivotal. And then that group went on to do another, a bunch of us went on to do another company together and had another 6-7 year run. And even coming into Flywire, and you know, there were a number of folks from Edox that were part of this business. And so that connection over time and having such a great start in tech was really pivotal for me. You know, I would say given the opportunity to be first-time CEO here at Flywire too, that was a clearly pivotal moment in my career. It was yet another job I didn't think I knew how to do or was ready for. I thought I'd be the shortest tenured CEO in the history of tech CEOs, but 10 years later, just having a great supportive board and people that were willing to take a bet on me, it was, you know, it's been an amazing career for me.
10 years as CEO, that's an impressive run of a tech company. Congratulations on that. Yeah. And you've been recognized for that success, Mike. In 2019, you know, you were a recipient of the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award in Financial Services, which, as the award states, recognizes unstoppable entrepreneurs who redefine the way we work, live, and play. Can you talk about the experience of getting that recognition?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it still is a little overwhelming. It's a very high profile award. It's, you know, very kind of sought after award. It's also not something that, you know, I love being called out for. It's like individual accomplishments. So much of what we've done building Flywire is not about me. It's been about, you know, what the company's done, what the Flymates have done building that company. Come to later realize, you know, the great recognition it provided us as a company and all the great work we were doing. But for me, I was completely shocked. I mean, I was up with a whole bunch of, you know, really amazing people in that award category. I didn't have a speech written. And I think I stumbled through something as I got up there, and it's forever on the internet out there. But in general, I mean, you know, looking back on it, it was just such fond memories to be able to, you know, have that level of recognition, but not my favorite to get individual awards, just not my style.
But you didn't start your career as an entrepreneur.
Right. I often say I was a reluctant entrepreneur. So I joined Flywire. I was part of that kind of founding team, but not the CEO at the time. And I actually got the opportunity to take the company over. I actually declined the CEO job a couple of times, told the board, go find somebody that knows what they're doing or has done it before. And the board was quite persistent. They knew I was at the company for about a year, and they knew I kind of understood the company quite well, and obviously saw something that I didn't quite see in myself. So I was always saying I was the kind of reluctant entrepreneur that took over at about 30, 40 employees, less than $500,000 of revenue. And it was losing about $5 or $6 million a year. So it was not the business that looked like it is today as a multi-billion dollar publicly traded company.
So it was losing $5 or $6 million a year when you took over as CEO.
Yeah.
Could you walk us through that critical time?
Yeah. I mean, it was early. I mean, we were still going product market fit. Now we're multi-vertical across multiple industries and geographies. But back then we were all focused on cross-border tuition payments for universities in the United States. And the product was starting to work, but I often will say that the business didn't perform like the spreadsheet told it to. We had modeled how this business was supposed to perform and scale, and the product was working, but how you monetize the payments, how you monetize the software, how you deployed the software, how quickly revenue would ramp, all of that was really hard to predict. And so as you built up the company, you're obviously burning a lot of money and kind of waiting for the revenue to kick in. And, you know, as an early stage tech company, you're often very distracted as well. You get a lot of competing priorities. Sometimes it looks like you should pivot the company or develop a second or third or fourth product before your first one's even taken off. And so we were a bit distracted early on too. So what really was a big change was just looking at trying to be the best at one thing and getting that first product right. And then over time learned we could add additional industries, add additional products, scale the business globally. That's really where the success came from.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about, actually from that perspective, Mike, share with us a little bit about what is some of the best advice that you've been given, whether it's as you were becoming in that CEO role or other things along the way. Share with us some advice that you got that really stuck with you.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I struggled with becoming CEO, and I've actually applied this advice to even just personal life as well, was I thought initially my job as the CEO or as any leader is to like prevent things from breaking or to make things work perfectly. And I remember something my chairman told me. I was fortunate when I became CEO, another Flywire board member was nice enough to become chairman. I joked I didn't want two jobs I didn't know how to do. And so my chairman has been a long time board member at Flywire. And he said to me, only him and my mother call me Michael, but he said, Michael, you know, your job isn't to prevent the company from breaking. Your job is to identify something's wrong and fix it as quickly as you can. And to me, that was like an eye-opening moment, right? Because, you know, you have so much angst of trying to make everything perfect. And in a high growth environment, it really is impossible, right? Things are going to inevitably break. And all you can do is better understand what isn't scaling and try and identify and fix it quicker. And frankly, even in personal life, I always tell Flymates, like when you're out of sync, when you're, you know, losing focus on what you love doing in your personal life, it's not really something to, you know, focus on and be upset about, just fix it as quick as you can, right? If you need more time with the family, carve out that time. If you need more time to exercise or pursue a hobby, it's okay. It's okay to trip up. You just get back on track as quick as you can. And for me, that was a huge kind of life moment, both personally and professionally.
What's the best advice you give to others who are thinking about stepping into the CEO role or who are leading fast-growing companies?
I would always say, you know, try and really think through, I would say, values and how you want to operate inside the business. One of the difficult parts about culture, you know, people would always say this early on inside the company, you guys have an amazing culture. And I'd always joke, I had no idea what they mean because we were just trying to, you know, build a company, right? And we didn't actually have a lot of time to define it early on. And so we often say we unearthed our culture and didn't define it, right? Like some people create these kind of big lofty statements, some of which they don't even remember themselves. And for us, we just looked for ways in which we could describe how Flymates acted or behaved and how we wanted to operate as a team. And that became kind of our core set of values. And that's what led to our culture. So I'd say anybody stepping into any position of leadership or, you know, team leadership or CEO role, I think you got to look at, you know, is the culture clear? Is it defined? Is that how people actually act? Or is it aspirational? Because if it's not how people actually act or how you want people to behave inside the company, it's actually very inauthentic, right? And so it's really important to have that aligned, especially before you go into kind of a high scale mode.
Yeah, that's really great advice.
Question to follow up on the overall culture piece. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are important issues for businesses to focus on. What has been the position of Flywire on this, and how do you communicate that to your team and the community?
Yeah, I mean, Flywire has a bit of a unique footprint. I mean, we're a global team, as I mentioned. You know, we're 40 different nationalities inside the company, 30 languages spoken. So it's a very uniquely diverse company, especially for our size. And so for us, we have that as a benefit. It's also a challenge, right? It means you have different time zones. You have all types of different geopolitical, political, cultural differences that you're also dealing with as a company. It's not an easy environment when you have people scattered all over the world. And one of the things I realized is you actually have to look at targets and benchmarks, right? And for us, it's even a bit more complicated because you actually have to look at different regions, right? What does diversity mean in Singapore versus Israel versus China? And so you have to think through at a global level what you mean by you know, DE&I initiatives and what those targets can be. The other thing I'd highlight, which was massively eye-opening to me, was something our chief people officer, Gary Cunningham, really brought me along with, which I thought was fascinating, which his view's always been equity, inclusion first, and it will lead to diversity, right? If you can solve for equity and inclusion, you will inherently become more diverse over time because you've created that environment that brings in the diversity. And he's always a big believer that the words are reversed and that you have to focus on equity and inclusion first. And if you get that right in your culture, it will lead to a more diverse workforce. And so I think it's a combination of that mindset and then also just setting targets and being okay if you can't hit those targets, at least you've set them, you put out clear direction, and you set new ones in the subsequent years.
That's great advice. I really like the thinking of it in a different way from the out of order or different order. That's really insightful. So you've built such a great culture and obviously a great company. So let's talk about Boston overall. What are some of your observations on Boston and the business outlook in our city and in the region? And based on that, what are you optimistic about and what worries you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the things that I've always loved about Boston, you know, we kind of have a get down to business kind of mode. In some ways, we're not great self-promoters as much as the West Coast has historically been in tech. But, you know, you continue to see great companies get built in Boston. And so I think that's probably what makes me so optimistic, right? These companies that are built here, you know, they always lead to more companies being built here. And I think that gives me a lot of encouragement. I think one of the things that is concerning is the world's changed. And so the future of work has changed. So although Boston has kind of so many great things between great tech background, academics, biosciences, all these great industries, you know, I think the future work's a bit uncertain, right? You've got a lot of companies trying to figure out, are they pulling people back to the office? Are they mandating it? Even those that are trying to mandate it are only really having success Tuesday through Thursday. You've got commuting, which is a challenge, probably one of the bigger challenges inside and around Boston. We're behind in public transport and some other things that make it really challenging to tell people, hey, get into the office during normal business hours. It can mean a 60 or 90 minute commute each way for some people that aren't even coming from that far. So I think there's some kind of systemic challenges we have around that kind of dynamic around getting into the city that hopefully can get fixed. But, you know, never been more optimistic around kind of the talent that we have here, the talent to hire. And, you know, obviously we got, I think, the right people in charge to help drive some of that great change. But I think we have some work to do around future work and transport and living in and out of the city.
Let's hope that new transportation chief can make it happen.
I hope so.
And Mike, following up on that, what is your call to action for your peers and others in the business community who are listening in?
Well, you know, I would say the future of work, I think, is something that there can be a lot of good collaboration on. You know, I don't think there's a one size fits all approach. You've just seen people try so many different things as part of their strategy. And I think what you're seeing from employees, I think broadly, is that they don't want their time wasted, right? I think the pandemic has taught us that you can keep companies going, you can have companies excel even when everybody's not together. And so I think it's very inauthentic for people to say, okay, now that that's over, everybody back in the office. Like, even though businesses kept moving, they kept growing, people did amazing things in a difficult time. And so I think that's kind of the challenge that we're facing, where in-person time is exceptionally valuable. Employees agree with that. They just don't want their time wasted. And so the challenge is really on each individual company to figure out, how do you make an efficient environment in a hybrid mode? How do you bring people together for purposeful reasons, for great reasons that are hugely valuable? And I think that's an interesting challenge for all companies. I think there can be a lot of collaboration amongst companies that are figuring that out, because I think, you know, we're living in a time where we're going to define the future of work. And I think it is going to be hybrid, no matter, you know, how easy it is for people to say, let's just go back to how it was. I don't think the world's going that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's a great way to describe it, in terms of engaging the employees in a way that makes the most use of their time. Because we all love being together in person, but we all can't stand that drive.
Yeah, and going into an office and sitting on Zooms, like, that is the most ridiculous thing you can ever do to somebody. And that's not what people want to do with their time. So how do you change the schedule? How do you kind of turn things upside down and find ways to better align in-person time and hybrid time?
Mike, we like to close with some rapid fire questions. So off the top of your head, are you ready?
Yep.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Doctor or dentist. I would have been awful at either.
Thankfully, you're not. That's good.
My son did joke. He said, Dad does put on good Band-Aids. So that's about as far as I'd go if I was a doctor, I think. So glad I'm not that.
What are you currently reading and or watching?
You know, I am addicted to the book on Sumner Redstone, Unscripted, that just came out, and I'm just cranking through it, which is, it's kind of like the written version of the Succession show. It's unbelievable, and I can't put it down.
Who's a Boston leader or an organization that we should watch?
Man, one of my favorites has always been Corey over at Rapid7. He's awesome. I've, you know, been amazed as what he's done building that company. I think he's got a lot more to do for Boston and the tech ecosystem. He's probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, we had Corey Thomas on earlier on this PNCC speak. He was fantastic. Awesome. That's great. What's a favorite spot you have in the city?
Probably a little addicted to the Quinn right now. I just joined probably 3 or 6 months ago. And whenever I can get in there, you know, I'll just back up meeting after meeting, or dinner after dinner, coffee after coffee. I love the spot. I love the vibe. I love running into people randomly that I know in there. So absolutely love the Quinn.
What makes you laugh?
You know, I have a bunch of teenage boys right now, and we're into all types of kind of, ridiculous kind of comedy shows, or like Ted Lasso, The Good Life, Mythic Quest, like all these just kind of funny comedies that, you know, if I turn one on for 20, 30 minutes, there's always a lot of laughing happening in our house. Yeah,
that's great. It's fun to do that with your kids.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And finally, what's a wish you have for Boston?
You know, I hope it keeps this focus on innovation. I mean, we just have such amazing talent, so much history in investing in tech and leading in tech. I hope we can maintain it, even in the shift of everything happening around, movement and flexibility and work. You know, I think there's a lot of things that draw people to Boston and New England, frankly, and hopefully we can continue to keep that focus and just keep realizing the value of having companies built in Boston, around Boston. It's so important. It's so valuable. I mean, having built Flywire here and having seen what it's done for so many families and so many people, and it will create other companies. It will help drive the ecosystem. And it's just so important. So I hope we keep that focus, even with everything goes on with macro and political and everything. I just hope we just keep the focus and understand how important tech and business is to Boston and New England.
And that wraps up another episode. Thank you so much for joining us, Mike, and for sharing your insights. I'm John Bernstein.
And I'm Carolyn Jones, and this is PNC C-Speak, the language of executives. Our guest today was Mike Massaro, CEO of Flywire. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
You can find C-Speak at bizjournals.com/Boston or on any of your favorite podcast platforms. Until next time.